Welcome to Built Different, a podcast by boots-on-the-ground workers who are built different and like to get sight done.
We're here to listen, question the status quo, and continue to find better ways to build the world. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Built Different podcast. I am joined today by my two co-founders, Mr. Dan Zito and Mr. Philip Lorenzo. Do you guys want to say hi?
Hey, everyone. My name is Philip. My current role is Chief Data Officer, Construction Site. But I had many roles before that. I was the head of product before and just did a little bit of everything. I mean, all of us, I guess I'd say, did a little bit of everything here at Construction Site. But I'm the data guy.
Nice. I'm the data guy. Dan.
Yeah. Hello. Dan Zito. Happy to be here with my co-founders. And yeah, my role is Chief Technology Officer. And I've kind of always been, you know, building the tech that drives our product, focused on software development. That's what I know. That's what I do. And yeah, it's a big part of what we do here now.
Awesome. Yeah. So today we're going to do some story time. We're going to do a little storytelling. We're going to look at a little bit at the past. We're going to look, I think, a little bit at the present. And if we have time, we can jump into some of the future stuff too. But yeah, I think our goal today is just to help people understand a little bit about how we got here and how Construction Site started. So I'll kind of kick it off with a little bit of my own background and then maybe hand it off to Philip with that connection point over there at the Kaiser Oaken Hospital job. So yeah, sometime around 2013, was working for a company called Faro Technologies that makes 3D imaging and measurement products, mostly for aerospace and automotive, basically manufacturing businesses. So I had spent a lot of my time in the previous 9 years before Construction Site in, you know, a fab shop, machine shop for Boeing, plant for a car manufacturer. That's sort of where my world was. Sometime around 2010, that company launched a LiDAR scanner that scans buildings. And so suddenly I found myself on job sites talking to contractors. And of course, this is kind of like going back in time 20 years when you go from a manufacturing facility with robots and imaging devices everywhere. And then you get out on a job site and I see Philip walking around with a set of paper plans and a highlighter marking down stuff. So it was definitely just, it was pretty interesting to jump into the construction world. Yeah, I think it was 2010, Faro launched that scanner. So I find myself on the Kaiser Oakland Hospital project, about 20 minutes away from where I'm at now. And the contractor had really basically got the owner, which is Kaiser in this case, very, very interested in some laser scanning deliverables. And they were going to laser scan the floors. They were going to laser scan the steel. And this is stuff that just wasn't really being done at the time. This is like very, very early days for using this type of data to produce floor flatness deliverables to the ASTM E1155 spec, to be able to tell you what the steel was doing as the concrete deck was being poured. And yeah, so I just, my sort of wrapping up of this story is, I just remember Philip was the guy. So their company buys a scanner and Philip is the poor guy who's got to figure out how the heck to actually deliver this information to their client using this LiDAR data and a piece of software that frankly wasn't built to do what he needed to do. And so I get these late night emails and phone calls from this like punk kid who's telling me, dude, your software sucks. And I just remember being like, you should like, first of all, who is this person? And like, second of all, if you think you should do it, you know, better, like go ahead. And so, yeah, that's kind of the beginning of Philip and I's friendship, how we got to know each other. Philip, you want to jump in and maybe share a little bit of your experience there on the Kaiser job and things you were doing as a builder there?
Yeah, well, now that I'm on the other side, I definitely don't think that software generally sucks. It's just incomplete. It's just, there's got to be workflows that got to be built. Everyone has a different use case. I had a great working relationship with the team there, and they were doing some amazing things. But when it came to like actually getting it done, that was a whole different feel. It's kind of like all right, well, we'll promise this to the client, go ahead and deliver it. I was that person that had to get into the weeds and actually deliver it. It was fun, but it was a lot of late nights and a lot of custom plugin development and random. I was using a software called MATLAB to do a lot of the calculations on this huge gigabyte size point cloud data to be able to replicate the standards for how you check steel and concrete that was developed in the 80s, the 70s and 80s using these really traditional levels. And it was a long process and it was cool being able to be the person that can do that. And we got some awards, some like construction awards, tech awards, whatever. But being able to get, it's like this Biotech, which is like this facilities, engineering management, technology awards. It was cool. I mean, they liked it, but I mean, I didn't really care about it so much as like who else besides me can do this? Like that kind of mattered more to me. And when I tried to kind of train my replacement, like what we had to install MATLAB. We had to install this special like Excel plugin. It was such a, it made me realize, well, we got to really like wrap this up into some easy button. I mean, yeah, that's kind of a big takeaway is like, sure, you can make an impact on one project, but how do you make an impact on multiple? How do you make an impact on industry? That didn't really connect with me until me and you were like, all right, why don't we just use this API that Faro started offering. You can make your own plugin, you can customize stuff, you can do whatever you want. Like that really opened up the doors for us there.
Yeah, tell us about Rhythm.
Yeah, so Rhythm is short for algorithm. It's not the dancing rhythm, but like algorithm. I mean, that is, its goal was to create that easy button for customers. So you don't have to know much about the technology, the algorithms, the steps. Like it abstracts away a lot of the analysis of a building for floors, concrete. It was a very niche product, I got to say, because like it focused on certain aspects of construction. You had to have a certain laser scanner. But I got to tell you, we really owned that niche. Back when like these Faro scanners started coming out, Autodesk coined the term reality capture. Like that was a whole new word. Remember, Matt, like they had this whole conference around it. Like they're trying to create so much hype around scanning. And there was like a myriad of companies getting to the space. Hey, we can capture your building. It's like being there. Like that was part of that whole revolution. And these construction companies started having these reality capture departments. And I remember with Rhythm, people would buy our software, but then I would actually be flying around the country, living out of my suitcase practically. I mean, so did you, Matt, selling these scanners. But like, all right, I want to use Rhythm, but I want to know, how do you actually do reality capture? How do you capture and know what's, you know, analyze your building? And so we did more than even just create software. We started getting to thought leadership. Like, this is the best practice. This is how you do it. So we pretty much got to know like so many of these like BIM tech decision makers for GCs all across the country, just from that, from tackling that niche, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I still remember, I think one of my favorite stories from the Rhythm days were, you know, flying out to Jacksonville, Florida to the ASTM conference to basically try to lobby and convince them to put a laser scanner in as an acceptable apparatus for the E1155 spec, so that you could scan and actually meet the spec by actually scanning it instead of using, you know, the 20-year-old manual analog device that had been patented a couple decades before. But you know, what I remember about Rhythm too, and even just obviously my time with Faro, was the thing that was really tough to scale was the scanner itself and LiDAR data. I think one of the major learnings there was like scanning technology is a little ways out from really being scalable. You know, I couldn't hand this thing to a superintendent and say, go scan the job. They would never do that. And so, yeah, we were kind of stuck in this very niche world of what can we do with LiDAR data based on the amount of time people will actually put into collecting it. And the thing that the big turning point for us was 360 photos. You want to talk through that? Because I still remember you like sharing this very rough PowerPoint presentation with me that was like, this is the thing we've been waiting for. Here's what we could do with a 360 camera instead of a scanner.
Yeah, when those 360 cameras came out, I mean, actually, one of those Kickstarter campaigns, and they were releasing this 360 camera. I was one of the first ones on it. Yeah, that really changed the game. You know, a lot of like tech companies that have grown very fast in our space, and just tech companies in general, they typically jump on the wave of like a new hardware that becomes this mass market, right? Obviously, like this cloud becomes mass market, mobile becomes mass market. But when iPads came mass market, you had a company like PlanGrid skyrocketed just from the iPad. So the 360 cameras were what really was kind of the wave that we really rode there, where it was, you can just go to Best Buy or Amazon, you can get a camera next day, you know, same day, and just start capturing so much of your job site that was not possible. And in a way that is similar to using a $50,000 scanner. Yeah, that was really instrumental for us. I was like, Matt, you know, I think we can do something with this. The first idea for it was some lame VR app, which, you know, it's still cool. Like there's companies that do that now. We probably spent almost 100 hours on iterating on a PowerPoint presentation until people were like, yeah, you know, this is something I would actually use and pay for. And maybe we can actually build a scalable business around it. That's part of that story.
Yeah, I mean, I also remember delivering something to one of our early customers who was like, this is awesome, but it looks so bad, I can't show it to my client yet. And it was just like, that's kind of where, you know, the part of the story that nobody wants to tell, right? Where, you know, you got to begin. And really part of like our journey doesn't really totally begin until our other two co-founders, Dan here and Manuel, joined the team and really jumped in to do the actual work of building the software we needed to build in order to take this thing from an idea to actual reality. And you know, the thing that got me there across the line was, you know, Philip doing what every great entrepreneur does and putting a PowerPoint together and getting a lot of people to buy into that vision for what could be via that PowerPoint. That's kind of what got me over the line.
Well, and not just figuratively buy in, like literally buy in, like sign this, send us a check before. So actually it's getting someone to actually put their money where their mouth is a whole different ballgame compared to just being like, yeah, that's so cool, I'd use it, you know, because it removes that whole bias of them being your friend or them liking you. And when real dollar bills are placed, which it was a $5,000 buy-in to use it. And our first command was from Josh Stefano from DPR, but that like was some real momentum there, some real backing, real buy-in.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, Dan, I'll kind of tee you up here with my background here. So I met Dan back in college, UC San Diego, which by the way, there's like we don't talk enough about the fact that there's actually people coming out of UC San Diego that have done a few things here and there. You know, they've got a great name in biotech and some other areas, but two UCSD grads here. I remember looking up Dan and being like, who could help actually build this thing, and coming to visit you at Google that fateful day. And just being totally like, wow, you've got it made. This looks nice. It was a one market or whatever that was. And thinking to myself, like, how in the heck are we going to convince Dan to leave this and go work in his garage or house or whatever and basically start building this thing from scratch with us? Dan, you can speak to your own version of that story. But yeah, when it came time to roll up our sleeves and actually build some software, that was you at the beginning.
Yeah. And Matt, I remember that fateful day, that lunch we had together. I was just excited to hear about what you and Philip were doing. At that point, I hadn't even met Philip yet, and kind of roughly following what you guys were up to with Rhythm. And I was eager to hear kind of what this next iteration was, even though if it was called StructInsight at the time yet. But it was really the idea that germ, more than a germ, actually. And that's what impressed me about where you guys were at, and where these two guys were at with. It was more than just a good idea. It was proven, it was validated. Like Philip said, having that check in hand, or multiple checks from people who, even a very rough, not even a prototype, they just, you know, it's compelling enough that they're willing to wait to come to life in a way that they can actually use it. That's one of the elements here that caught me from the beginning. My background, like I said, is in software development. As you guys know, I've been doing this professionally for, gosh, almost 20 years now. And one of the great things about working in software is it's such a creative field, right? There's so many different avenues you can take with technology. And so for me, it's been a journey of learning, right? Like I've worked in a number of different industries. Before Google, I worked in ad tech. And before that, I worked at Tesla. And before that, I worked in digital marketing. And so lots of ways to learn about different industries and like how people are working and how technology can enable them. And, you know, for me, it's been also about doing side projects and having an entrepreneurial bent. It's like taking an idea and seeing what you can do with it. People who follow startups know it takes a lot more than an idea they're good ideas, right? They're a dime a dozen. And I think what impressed me about Philip and Matt, like you guys had proven this idea. And on paper, of course, it made perfect sense, right? Like Philip, like you said, the technology is there now with these 360 degree cameras. Like, let's go build software around that unlocks these workflows. And for me, that's super exciting, right? To just kind of create something from scratch, right? That resonates with people, and it's going to change how they work for the better. So yeah, Matt, like probably I could see where, you know, you're walking into that Google's office in San Francisco. It looks great, and it's a great place to work for sure. But there's something exciting about an idea whose time it has come and having the right team to do it. And as soon as I met Philip, there was no doubt, like this was the right team to get this off the ground, and Manuel as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about Y Combinator for a minute. You guys remember that? it was like trying to get this thing off the ground, right? It's 2017. We launched that summer, two customers. App is working, but you know, still pretty rough around the edges. That's where I remember getting that comment from, I think it was Justin Porter at Trubeck, or maybe Alex Snyder. And they were like, this is great, but it needs to look a little nicer before we go show our client what we're doing here. And so that's just where we were. And so obviously it started to improve. We got some design work, things were really sort of cooking. And we applied to Y Combinator, and we went through that process a couple of times. Like, what do you guys remember about that process?
It's a little nerve-wracking, wasn't it? You know, that was a big deal for us at the time to kind of see the doors that can unlock, right? To get into a program like Y Combinator. And I think we were pretty confident in our ability to do that, as I recall. But it's hard. Even if you have something really strong, like the competition to get into that program is fierce.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, even the act of trying to get ready for it and making sure your pitch like already transforms the company in a way. Like it makes you a lot more serious. It adds a much higher level of scrutiny to what you're doing. And that already like indirectly proves what we're doing, getting it or not.
Yeah, I remember this as getting to the interview stage twice, only to be crushed by the reality. And I still remember very vividly, and you're sitting in your living room, Dan, waiting for that phone call late night and feeling like, man, this has got to happen. We have such an awesome team. We've got a product that's in the market. Like, this has got to happen. And getting, what's that?
Some revenue.
I know. Right. We had a lot of reasons to be confident. And I remember being crushed by not sort of feeling like we were ready for that. And ultimately having to hear that, it just looks like what you're doing here might just be PlanGrid. PlanGrid should just do this. And I think that's like a very common thing that investors say about their portfolio companies is it kind of looks like the thing you're doing might be a feature and not a platform. And yeah, I remember that being definitely a low point. And sometime after that, being bullish enough on what we were doing, like we believed enough in it, that we made some interesting decisions about how to fund the business, you know, basically with credit card debt, right? Doing things that you do when you believe in what you're doing, but you look back and you're like, wow, that was risky. And so that was that, you know, I kind of remember taking us through that phase and us being willing to make that bet on ourselves. But then 500 startups, right? And all of a sudden there's on the other side of the table, there's an investor who I remember whose father, I think, worked for a mechanical contractor. And so it kind of took someone else from the space that had a connection to it, who was like, I see what you guys are doing. I get this. Like, we're in. And I remember that program being pretty transformational for us. I don't know. Like, what do you guys,
that was,
what are the memories?
That was a pivotal moment. And I think that was a theme too, is like, there are people, there's like a class of investor and customers, of course, too, who get it, right? Because they understand the problem we're solving, either through first or second hand, right? And nowadays, we see that on the team here, if people work at Struction Site, a large portion have that personal connection to construction and like understand the challenges that are faced there. And I think that's different to maybe other tech companies, right, who've gone through those types of accelerator programs where it's maybe a little bit more of an abstract idea or something a little more trendy or what have you that gets accepted because there's more press about it. Whereas, you know, we're kind of bucking the trend at the time, as I remember it. But yeah, that was a pivotal moment getting into 500 startups, definitely.
It also, I mean, we went through this three and a half month program, and we were like in person working and hashing things out like every day. And it was definitely a transformational experience because we started the company like really just being fully remote, right? And not really getting to connect or, you know, understand how to work kind of closely together. We're still a fully remote company now, but having once in a while in-person conversations sometimes just accelerates certain things.
Yeah, I mean, that was also where there was a couple mega projects we were on that we learned a lot on, right? And Chase Center in the Bay Area was one of those projects where we were in the field using the product, going back, you know, taking a scooter from Chase Center back to the 500 startups office back when, you know, we all took scooters everywhere because that was the thing to do. And I just remember like having a hard hat and a vest and a bird or like, you know, or a lime. Going back and forth between the Chase Center and the 500 startups office.
At least you had like that bright vest on and a hard hat. So you were safe on that scooter, no doubt.
Felt safe. I felt probably way safer than I was on the streets of San Francisco on a scooter that goes, you know, 20 miles an hour or whatever that thing does. But yeah, I definitely felt safer with an orange vest on. There was no doubt. But yeah, that was a pretty sort of transformational, I think, experience for us. And I'm super, super grateful for the team at 500 Startups, folks that went through that batch with us. And just for that experience, I think for any other first-time founder that's thinking about it, right? We did it Dan, because we knew another founder that had gone through it. That was really what convinced us to go through it. And I think I would recommend it to others, especially, you know, when you're like us and you're a first-time founder, you're trying to figure all this out. There's a lot to learn and you need a good network and you need some people who can help you along the way. And so I think I could probably speak for all of us when I say like, we're super, super grateful for that opportunity.
100%.
Yeah, it's so much more than just coming with an idea and building it, hashing it out. There's so much of this go-to-market process, customer success building and architecting that it's really hard to learn on your own. They really streamline that and accelerate your progress. So yeah, that an accelerator like that, or just any in general, been amazing.
So let's talk about a couple of the big sort of, I guess you could call them product ideas, pivots, changes, whatever you want to call them, right? So one of them was around that time, and it was Video Walk, right? I think Philip, you remember being out at the Chase Center on the days, and I know Dan, you were out there some days too, where you're out there taking a picture every 20 feet and we're searching for a better way. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh yeah. I mean, having to use your own app to capture 3 million square foot project weekly, it made me like, so at that point we were add 362 photos on a drawing app. And like, that's really all we were. It was also like a slower camera. We were using the Ricoh's more original one. You had to pause a little bit longer, but anyways, yeah, it took so long and I hated using our app. I was like, man, this is so slow. I could be so much faster if I can just like walk around. There's gotta be a better way. We had to innovate for sure. The biggest limiting factor for us is time it takes to capture. I mean, it still is. And you know, there's some newer technologies coming out there, like autonomous, that's gonna accelerate that even more. But back then, having to stop was being able to create a workflow where you don't have to stop was a complete game changer for us. Wasn't easy to build though, and we're still continuing to improve and automate it. But yeah, Dan has some fun stories to share about that.
I mean, yeah, the idea was like we just had to solve the capture speed problem, right? And again, like at that point where we were really feeling the pain of the workflow breaking down at the Chase Center, 3 million square foot project, right? To keep up with that, like these cameras were coming to market, like there were new cameras coming out that were faster and could record video. So, right. That was just the problem to solve. Was like, how can we use video to do this much, much faster? And yeah, it definitely was at that stage, we were hacking together, right, as fast as we could, a product that fit the solution. And so to kind of go back and rework what we had to accommodate this new pipeline, right, for taking in videos was a pretty heavy lift. And, you know, team was super small. I think we had maybe a couple of contractors we were working with on the development side. So figuring out like what's the shortest path to get there and being hyper efficient to do that. That was a lot of fun actually to see this come to life, to get on the whiteboard, kind of draw out how it would work, and then just go and, you know, have like marathon coding sessions. Later that week, go back out to the Chase Center and try it and test it. Like what a better way to get that feedback loop than actually using it in the field.
Oh, we were scrappy. That's right.
Hop on your Lime or your Bird and get down there and start recording some videos. Yeah, I mean, I have very fond memories of our time there in the city and as well. Maybe let's move a little bit closer to present day. We've got a capture platform that's rapidly growing. We've got a really differentiated and like pretty great way of capturing data. And then we kind of start to think about what comes next. And a lot of this is sort of being driven by our customers, but also sort of just fill up your own experience and I think intuition around what could we do with this. And sort of along comes SmartTrack. And I still remember hearing about the time that you had spent on the job site. You know, we like to basically say you were a summer intern for one of our customers, walking around with your paper sheets and your actual highlighters tracking interiors. Tell us a little bit about that and kind of what kind of led us to SmartTrack.
I mean, I remember needing to track even like the install stuff as a PE, but no matter how long you've been in construction, other customers, other people have different experiences, different ways of doing things. And yeah, I went back out to the field, now being on a software company, but still needing to be in the shoes of the people that are in the field. I remember being kind of an intern for them. I'll help you track your stuff. You know, I'll you know, you don't have to pay me. I'll be your free help. They had me go every week and track the install of like walls and ceilings and all that. And then they taught me everything in terms of how they go about doing it. They'll put everything into Bluebeam, then they'll put into the system to quantify it. Then they start to like use it in meetings. be able to see that firsthand and see its potential, what value we'd be able to provide if we were to automate that, and also like how we should be building something that will more or less like one-to-one replace a lot of what we're doing. The only way to really know that is to see it being used firsthand, you know, on projects. That was a pretty awesome experience. And yeah, and in general too, like we were just being used so much on projects in terms of like capturing job site progress. There's so much opportunity to unlock more from that data, like that raw imagery data. So it's just, you know, it makes so much sense just to analyze it.
Yeah. And I think we'll kind of wrap up here with Dan. I'm going to pass the mic here to you for a minute with basically, I think you did something that it's really difficult for technical leaders to do. And that took a lot of courage at one point when it was very non-obvious to invest in a new type of technology and a new series of technologies to build and scale the business. And you can look back on it now and say, that was a great decision, but it wasn't obvious at the time that it was. Would love to hear a little bit about why Elm and Rust and what led you to that and how has it impacted us today?
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a topic I'm very fond of is just, there's always, technology continues to innovate, right? And you can make a decision to grab a hold of that, or you can kind of stick with what's proven, what's mature, right? Like there's an old saying in software, right? Like, you know, nobody ever got fired for choosing Java, right? Kind of like nobody got fired for choosing IBM, but it's so old that, yeah, like you could do it and it will work and you can find people who know it. But what's more exciting to me is to grab a hold of the new and hopefully improved, right? And so, yeah, Elm and Rust, those are two programming languages that at the time were not too widely known. But I think it's still true. Like the, you know, software developers who know those languages are very fond of them. There's like these lists that come out every year, like the most loved programming languages. And I was tinkering with both of them and was like, wow, this would be really great to use at work. But nobody's really hiring. Very few companies are hiring folks to do that. And so that the idea there was like, what if we could be one of them, right? Like, are there enough engineers, software engineers out there who we could find some, like come work at Struction Site. And that's kind of what happened actually. And really like that wasn't the only reason. These languages are superior to the status quo languages in a lot of ways. Like Elm is a replacement for JavaScript. Anything you can do in a web browser, like, right, which is a big part of our product, you can build that with Elm and you get more stability, right? So when we made those, when we started building on those languages, we also saw improvements to our user experience. Right. We were spending less time fixing bugs and going back and doing rework. When we wanted to change something, we could do it with more confidence. And that's super valuable, especially to a startup that's innovating, right? That's still finding what exactly is going to work. And in every case, to have that ability, that's like a superpower to go back and change something without the whole house of cards falling down. Right. And that's what these languages provide for us. So yeah, Rust now, you know, you see these days, like every major tech company now has using Rust somewhere. That's been really cool to see that spread as well.
Yeah, man. I mean, you were ahead of the curve. I think it's safe to say that when it came to those. And I think we've really benefited from that. And yeah, I think that we've got this amazing team of engineers here now. We're super passionate about the technology they get to use here at Struction Site.
Yeah, full credit to our team. Like I could say, I saw this happening, but really like they're the ones who built what we have with Struction Site, you know, using this technology. And like, it's very brave too to like bet your career on some tech that very few companies are hiring for, which they've done.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Well, look, Dan, we recently celebrated your 5-year anniversary. Congrats, really, which is like really our 5-year anniversary. That's kind of like the group's milestone there. And it's just so hard to imagine how far we've come. And just appreciate everything about you guys. And this has been so much fun. And thanks for jumping on here and sharing a little bit of history with us.
Yeah, likewise, Matt. It's fun to reminisce every once in a while, isn't it? We spend a lot of time looking forward. It's fun to look back.
Totally. Right on. All right, you guys. Well, that'll wrap it up for this week. And we will see all of you all here on the Built Different podcast soon. Take care, guys.
Built Different is brought to you by Struction Site. To find out more about us, head to structionsite.com.
Make sure to search for Built Different in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. Click follow so you don't miss out on any future episodes.
On behalf of everyone here at Struction Site, thanks for listening.